This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. Ever as before, and ever just as sure as the sun will rise. Oh, oh, oh,
Hi, I'm Stephanie Potter, and I'm with the Radio Z now, and I'm waiting here for Virginia Morell, who's just a couple of minutes away, and she's supposed to be here in the studio, and she's written a book called Animal Wise, and actually she's going to also be at Powell's on Burnside tonight to talk about her book. It's called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. Anyway, this is the Radio Zine. You're still tuned to KBOO Portland. And Virginia apparently is a little bit late because the plane got here later. I'm not sure what, but anyway, she will be here. It's all promised. And so meanwhile, I just like to say a little bit about her. She's traveled the world. She's a science writer. And she writes for magazines such as National Geographic, Science, the Smithsonian. And for Animal Wise, Virginia traveled all over to visit researchers who are learning about animal cognition and emotion. And I'd like to read this from the jacket. Morell exposes the expected brilliance of apes, dolphins, and parrots, but also surprises us with simple discoveries of genius among fishes and ants, and even laughter among rats. Each page of her book allows you to anticipate, to sweat, grieve, and celebrate with dedicated scientists as you discover and experience their worlds and those within the minds of the astounding animals they study. And I managed to read this book, Animal Wise, and I was just so impressed with so many things that are going on with it. There were like ants who are learning how to instruct each other, and they work very patiently. Like an ant might say that it wants to teach another ant how to follow itself to go to a piece of food or something, or to find another nest. And even though usually they're kind of in a hurry all the time, the ant that is trying to teach another ant how to do it will stop and wait and stop and wait until the second ant actually learns how to follow it and get back and forth by itself. There were articles or a study of fish who feel pain, and it's just amazing. It's like fishermen, I guess, over and over again have been told that, oh, you know, fish don't hurt. You know, just put a hook in their mouth, pull them out of the water. It's not a problem for them. But that was apparently because there's something to do with the amygdala. And we have an amygdala that's deep inside our brain, and we just assumed that they had no amygdala, which is where you actually suffer. And it turned out that they do have one. It's just on the outside of their brain, and it hadn't been recognized. And of course, there's like she's gone to places to see fish who can, birds who use tools and they solve problems, and they can do it just as well as primates do. And then she visited with a bird named Alec. Alex, who is just amazing, and he changed practically everything. He was able to learn so many words, and the woman that worked with him regarded him as her colleague, and was just very sad when he died because they had formed such a bond, even though he was a parrot. And he just learned so many words, could ask for things, would get show impatience, show humor, would show all kinds of different things that were just so human, actually. Dolphins were interesting. I mean, it's like they were able to work together in big groups, the guide dolphins, to figure out how to make things happen so that that they could actually find a female dolphin to mate. And they can't do that unless apparently three or four of them are working together. And so they learn to cooperate incredibly well socially. And with all their clicks and pops and the way they sort of communicate with each other, it's really looking like they have a real language. There was a work on what dogs are doing and wolves and how dogs are so incredibly different from wolves in really specific ways, actually related to how they connect with human beings. Oh, and I guess there's a video of Alex the parrot that maybe we could play right now.
All right. Aysan, are you excited?
Woo!
All right. Tell everybody your name. Oh, she's getting ready. She's got to clear her throat. Can you tell them your name?
Einstein.
Yes, Einstein. Say hi. Can you say hi?
Hello.
That's nice.
That was Alex.
Hi, sweetheart.
That's much better. Okay, let's start off with some animal sounds first. Can you do... Okay, got a clear throat. Let's do a wolf.
Ow!
Good. How about a bird? Can you do a bird? Good. Can you do an owl? Good owl. How about a rooster? How about a penguin?
So that's the end of Alec. But you could see that Alec just could hear what she was saying and then would just say it right back to her, you know, like quick, understanding what she was actually asking him to do. And he did this. He could recognize shapes. He could recognize colors. He could recognize they were figuring out abstract thoughts, things like that. And it was fascinating. I think one of the most interesting things to me when I was reading the book was a study of parrots, not in a laboratory, but in the wild. And a fellow named Berg had a ranch in Ecuador where he was able to place like something like 50 nesting boxes. And when he put these nesting boxes out, he was really able to study something called parrotlets, which were wild parrots there. And so these parrots were amazing. They were like all sort of gathered in these different nests, and they could like, she could feel one parrot. I mean, they could take the parrots in and out of their boxes. They could look at their eggs. They were getting used to people. And what was so great about that is that they started to see how these parrots would communicate, talk, whistle, and they were actually learning the sounds of their own name a lot to talk. And they were given a name, and then they were learning to say it from like being a baby bird. And it wasn't a genetic thing that they were learning these sounds. They were actually learning them from the adult parrots that they were growing up with. And so, like, one woman there, an Ecuadorian woman who is the wife, she's also a scientist, but she's the wife of another scientist, she was saying that these birds were they just had to have Latino drama in their lives. Because what was so trippy is there was... some of the birds would be maybe up on their boxes smooching and kissing. Other ones would be in a huff with each other, and the female would be down in the nest box and hardly deal with her husband. She was describing, infanticide, murder, stealing nest boxes from one another. There was just so many different weird ways that they were interacting with each other. And... But it was like they were just like in a social world that was, you know, sort of like a crazy human one. And yet they still would gather together. They're very social, flocking, conversing with each other. It was just amazing. And another thing about this that was incredibly touching to me was a Japanese fellow, Tetsuro Matsawa. He works with chimpanzees in Japan. And normally what's going on with the chimpanzees is that, you know, they're in cages when they're being studied and this and that and the other. He's keeping them really... Oh, I'm so glad she finally came. Thank you. Well, to set you up, Virginia is here. I can talk to you now.
Thank you.
I'm trying to, like, give a big speech about your book.
Thank you. You're free.
But anyway, is the microphone working? Can we hear Virginia?
Hello. It's nice to be here. Thanks very much. Sorry to be a bit late.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're here.
And, yeah, well, I am too. Thank you.
Let me see if I can find this. So I guess maybe I'll just start with, what made you want to write this book? I know that, I'm just like reciting all these great things about the animals that you were studying.
Oh,
but
thanks.
Is that what you wanted?
I really wanted to go out and, you know, I'd read a lot of these different stories about, oh, how fish can use tools, or how rats laugh, or how birds learn their songs in their sleep, or, you know, they practice their songs in their sleep. And so I wanted to meet the scientists who were actually making these discoveries and have them show me, how did they do this? How do you know that? And
yeah,
that's what I went out to find out.
I want to tell the listeners again that this is KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter with the Radio Zine. I'm speaking with Virginia Morell. She wrote a book called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. And I don't even know where to start, because now we only have 15 minutes.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. It's okay. I think I was talking a little bit about the chapter on fish and pain, and
yes,
you had actually been a fisher little girl and just assumed,
yes,
that they had no pain at all. But now, how has that changed your relationship to fishing? Or,
well, I had sort of, you know, not been fishing in a number of years, and the interesting thing was, a scientist I met who found that fish feel pain. She herself loves to fish, and she encourages her kids. She thinks it's a great way to develop a love for the outdoors, and I agree. But it does make you hesitate. I think I would follow her advice, which is to use barbless hooks.
Barbless hooks.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is such a thing. Oh,
there is such a thing, you know, because it does. And she, as she put it, the bigger question was not so much, do they just feel pain, but do they suffer? And she was able to show that.
Another thing I was sort of trying to get into just on my own, but I need you here to really do it. The Ecuadorian wife of one of the scientists.
Carl Berg's wife, yeah, Soraya.
And was sort of like talking about these birds, these parrots in Ecuador, needing a lot of Latin drama in their lives.
And yes. Yes, these birds are green-rumped parrotlets, and they mate obviously in pairs, but the males are advertising themselves by reciting all the names, basically, of the other males they know. And then the females listen and choose one of these fellows. And then the real thing that limits who is able to reproduce are the number of nest sites. And they usually nest in a hollow. So the scientists have provided them with a kind of a parrotlet condominium, a number of these specialized nesting boxes. And so they're able to follow the families quite closely, and they see things, oh, divorce and wife beater equivalents.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. Murder, infanticide.
Yes, they do. In fact, they do see murder and infanticide. If a female loses her mate when he's out foraging, say a raptor picks him off, she's there alone with the little chicks or the eggs, then another pair will come in and chase her away and then break the eggs and kill the chicks. It was shocking.
And there was a sense that they're actually gossiping about all this.
There is some sense to that, because they do know that each parrotlet has what's called a signature contact call, which is essentially saying his name or her name. And they make that call, and then they can, because they're parrots, they have the ability to imitate the calls of other parrots. So they can call a specific individual by name. So the male, when he's coming back to the nest to feed the female, he's calling his name and her name. And she will only come up if she hears her husband's voice. You know, she doesn't come up for any guy. The scientist believes that it's very likely that the birds are able to add some additional sounds to that name. Why not a sound of affect or a sound of dislike? You know, while Sue next door is a really, what a crummy neighbor we've got there, or Ben, boy, he's a swell guy. I really like to go foraging with Ben. Things of that sort. I mean, that's maybe a little bit putting too much human spin on it, but there isn't any reason, once you were able to sort of initiate communication contact with another individual by name, that you can't then exchange some information
about what they're like.
Exactly.
And it seemed like self-awareness and intelligence and that kind of thing. Of course, we have it as humans, but it's also in elephants, dolphins,
yes,
parrots, apes. So what's going on there with this? Like, and how do they actually show self-awareness?
Well, the way that they've shown self-awareness, the standard test is to have an animal recognize itself in the mirror. Well, how do you know that? And so they've devised a test in which they first get an animal used to a mirror, and then so that they understand a mirror's properties, that you're going to see a reflection and, you know, there's nothing behind the mirror. And then they put a daub of paint, you know, on the animal. So, or in the case of the elephants, they put some chalk marks on their foreheads, and the dolphins the same way. They put a mark on their side, so they would have to turn and look at it. And they see that animals then examine these. In the case of chimpanzees, they'll pick at the spot of paint, you know, and study it. In the case of the dolphins, they start turning almost over and over, trying to get a good look at what this mark is on their side.
Something weird on them.
Yeah, and even magpies, they've shown that in European magpies, that they will pick at, if you put a yellow daub of paint on them, they will pick at that spot, you know, looking in the mirror and then picking. They don't know it's there until they see it in the mirror, and then it's like, oh, I got to get this off.
Oh, they don't like it.
yeah. Spoiling my plumage.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and so this communicating then, it seemed like it sort of got to be happening more and more and more when there was like a complex society, and
yes,
where they were living longer too, that kind
yes,
of thing was
yeah,
really important.
A long lifespan does help, because then you have more things to learn. You have probably your kids aren't going to grow up as fast as, say, those of a mouse, and so you have a lot to teach. The kids have a lot to learn, and then throughout your lives you're learning, and you're not just learning where's the best place to get food, but what are your neighbors like and your family like, and everybody has a personality. That's one of the other interesting aspects of the new research, is just recognizing that animals have personalities, and that these then determine, can affect whether or not they're able to reproduce, what their kids are going to be like, how successful they are. And they always talk in terms of success as being reproductive success. How many copies of your genes do you pass on?
Uh-huh. That's the ultimate success.
That's the goal.
Okay.
Biologically speaking.
And so maybe talk a little more about personality. What kinds of personalities are they seeing?
Oh, I think one of my favorites was, you see, first of all, kind of a continuum between shy individuals and bold individuals. And so they've shown that even in lions, there'll be some lionesses where they put a speaker out, and the lioness are supposed, they hear this call and they think it's an invading female from somewhere else. So all the pride gets up. Where is that something or other? You know, I've got to hunt her and get her out of here. Well, some of the lions are very bold about doing this, and some of the females hold back and consistently, you know. And so they establish that as, well, those are the shyer ones, and the ones who are right there at the forefront to take on this invading chick, they're always bold. It's quite interesting. But there is a fellow at Seattle Aquarium who found personality in octopuses, and he said, you know, you could see it in the octopuses, sea otters, seals, all those animals, definitely. And he said, we had, you know, this one octopus that just every time you'd clean his aquarium, he'd get his arms just all over you. We called him Leisure Suit Larry. And there was a female that was really shy, and she'd get her 25-pound body squeezed down to this little tiny 3-inch space where she could kind of hide behind, and they called her Emily Dickinson.
Just like people.
Yeah.
And see, this is what really got me, how the researchers over and over again were referring to their animals as colleagues. I mean,
yes, yeah.
Irene
Pepperberg with Alex the Gray
Parrot.
And the
fellow that worked with the chimps.
Tetsuro Masasawa, and also Steve Ross at the Lincoln Park Zoo.
Could you just say a few words about that?
Well, I think it was something that that people, you know, once they start working with some of these intelligent or more animals that have a little bit more sophisticated cognition, they see that the animal is an individual and is responding with a personality and a sense of who it is. And so you develop a close relationship with that animal. And Irene Pepperberg certainly did with Alex, the gray parrot, who was her colleague for 31 years. And she tried to keep it very much, you know, he's just my research colleague. But when he died unexpectedly, she was just brokenhearted.
Yeah, I read
you know.
That in your book. Yeah. I was trying to talk about it. It's so sad.
Yes, it is. No, it was, and the same with Lou Herman when he lost his dolphins. And he said this really heartrending thing to me about how they were their colleagues, yes, but it was more than that. It was more than the loss of a pet. It was as if they'd lost their children because, you know, they were so excited about the findings that they were making with the dolphins. The dolphins were working with them. It was a true loving partnership.
A real partnership, yeah. And on a certain level, then, it goes so against the way that we treat animals normally. I mean, like, we treat them like that they're just almost, you know, our farms, our...
Yes, I think that, you know, there's been some efforts on farms to improve conditions, not perhaps in industrial farming, but, you know, more organically oriented farms.
Happy cows.
Yeah, exactly. Where was this chicken raised? That was one of my favorite parts of Portlandia, you know. So you see that. And then my biggest worry personally is just simply that we should try to allow enough habitat for the wild animals to exist.
That's huge. Yeah.
And that's where you see some of the biggest concerns coming in, because animal population will get down to just a few hundred individuals because we've just consumed so much of their space. And then we always make this really big concerted effort to try to save that species. We don't want other species to go extinct, but
we want to build our McMansions out in the woods. And
there is a really lovely quote that from Jonathan Franzen. He wrote some observations of his passion for bird watching, and he said he wondered why birds are always having so much trouble. Everywhere he went, it seemed like the birds were in dire straits. And he said he finally figured it out. It's that birds are poor. And everywhere they want to live is a Tony spot. You know? They want that posh waterfront. They want the place in the mountain and by the meadow where people want to build their homes. And he said they just don't have the money. They can't compete. And, you know, I think that's just pretty much it.
They can't speak and ask for what they want. They don't. There's nothing for them.
No, and they don't have the finances
to afford the beautiful home.
They don't.
And again,
or at least the view. You know
what I mean? And then in the Amazon, where they're dredging out the oil and mowing things down, or everywhere, it's just incredible.
You know, we're pretty much all over the planet.
Yes, definitely. And yet, And we also have some kind of notion that we're better. I love this quote by Tetsuro Matsawa.
Yeah.
I do not understand this need for us always to be superior in all domains or to be so separate, so unique from every other animal. We are not. We are not plants. We are members of the animal kingdom.
Yes. Yeah. I love that too. And then he also said this wonderful thing when he showed that a chimpanzee he studied had this really amazing photographic memory. It could look at a screen with numbers randomly put up, actually in numeral form, 1 to 9, and then the screen would just flash those numbers up very quickly, boom, gone. And it was like he'd take a mental picture, a photograph of them, and then he could put all the numbers back in the correct order. And he did this with a touch screen. And so, anyway, it exasperated other people that this chimpanzee could do it. And that was the one study that he's gotten the most criticism on is, oh, you know, chimpanzees shouldn't be better than us. And but it's only on this one thing.
Right,
it's
but they
it's
have
really
a
curious.
Superb photographic memory, it sounds
They
like.
Seem to, yeah. Yeah. And it would be very handy if you were going to pick fruit, you know, if you're way of making a living is climb that tree and pick this fruit, then you're going to, if you just look up and see where all the fruit is, if you've got a quick memory like that, then You're going to remember where they are, and it's going to help you to grab things quickly.
And, and even archer fish have this like incredible ability to
copy
calculate.
Each other. Yeah, and calculate. They do these incredible calculations in order to shoot down their insect prey.
Yeah.
And then they can learn by watching one another. So if you've got a real talented sharpshooter who's hitting really hard targets, you just watch that for a little while, and then it's like you've become Kobe Bryant of the archer fish.
Yeah.
And you just make the shot yourself. It is pretty remarkable.
So they can have incredible mental talents way beyond us. Yeah.
Well, they're different. Even, yeah, some of them are way beyond it. I mean, that is certainly something that we can't do. We do learn by watching each other, but usually we
have
to practice.
Yeah.
So that was a very exciting finding for the fish, and especially given the size of their minds. And that researcher, too, said something I found so interesting. Stefan Schuster commented that he didn't really believe that you need to have a big brain to be intelligent or
that
to evolve intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah.
That you could do it with a small brain, too.
Bird brain.
or fish brain. If, you know, your habitat, where you lived, what you were doing for a living, your social life, whatever, if it required intelligence, you were going to become intelligent.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very
nice.
That is so interesting. Yeah. And so basically, then, it seems like we really need to change a lot of our attitude toward animals, I think, and over, you know. I mean, your book just opens up a world of how we could change our attitude.
Yes, that was actually, I ended the whole book with that question. You know, now that we know that other animals have thoughts and emotions, are we going to change our relationship? Are we willing to think about how we treat other animals and to sort of draw back and look at the ants and look at the birds around us and the fish and say, gee, they are making decisions too about life and all of the things that we wonder about, how to make a living, how to find a mate, how to raise the kids. Most species are thinking about these issues too, and they too have to make decisions.
Right, and it even goes with the Buddha phrase, may all beings be happy.
That's true. You know? That's very nice. Yeah,
not just humans. Okay, so anyway, I just want to let listeners know, Virginia, thank you for finally getting here. And let listeners know, I've been speaking with Virginia Morell, author of a beautiful book. It's called Animal Wise, The Thoughts and Emotions of Our Fellow Creatures. She'll be speaking at Powell's on Burnside in downtown Portland tonight at 7 p.m.
Yes, I will.
Okay. And
looking forward to it.
Again, just thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Stephanie Potter. This is the radio's... I'm Stephanie Potter, the Radio Zine on KBOO Portland. And thanks, Sam, for engineering. And thank you for listening.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And Artemis Foods, Portland's local organic and sustainable catering company since 2001. Special events, corporate and wedding catering with seasonal menus and service supported by sustainable business operations. They offer full service and drop-off catering. Information by phone or through their website, www.artemisfoods.com. You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is 12:01 p.m. Stay tuned for the noon headlines.
This is KBOO News at noon. A University of North Carolina rape victim is being brought before the University Honor Court for speaking out about her rape. Landon Gamble, who could potentially be expelled while her rapist remains a student at the school, is being charged with being disruptive or intimidating toward her rapist and adversely affecting his life by speaking out with her story, even though she has never publicly identified the rapist by name. It is suspected that the university is taking the action in revenge for Gamble providing supporting evidence for a former dean who charges that the university is intentionally underreporting date rape on campus. A Maryland court recently ruled the police department in their state may not take DNA samples from individuals who are arrested but never convicted of a crime. The ruling resulted when the Salisbury, Maryland Police Department used DNA samples from an attempted rape 6 years earlier to convict a man recently charged with second-degree felony assault. The court ruled that the original samples could not be legally admitted because the man was never convicted of the original crime but pleaded guilty to a lesser charge with which DNA sampling is not allowed.
A coalition of citizens groups, states, and the EPA announced a long-sought agreement Monday with American Electric Power to have that corporation stop burning coal by 2015 at three of its power plants in Indiana, Ohio, and Kentucky. The company is planning on replacing at least some of the power supply needs with wind and solar installations in Indiana and Michigan. Coal-fired power plants are the greatest source of mercury, sulfur dioxide pollution, carbon pollution, and many other contaminants that can cause heart attacks and add to the possibility of respiratory problems. Routinely cruising in the left lane on freeways and multi-lane state highways may soon become illegal. Senate Bill 511, sponsored by Democratic State Senator Ginny Burdick, will make it illegal to drive in the left lane when not passing. The restriction applies today only to freight trucks and vehicles pulling campers and trailers.
The ACLU is challenging the U.S. government's censure of torture testimony by defendants at the Guantanamo hearings, saying the practice is legally indefensible and morally objectionable. Last Thursday, the ACLU filed a petition to enforce the public's constitutional right of access to the military prosecution of individuals accused of the 9/11 attacks, saying the public interest in these proceedings, the most important terrorism prosecution of our times, could hardly be greater.
At least 21 states are debating bills to limit drugs.